Succession number 20518, Reel 2.
Bryn Richardson, Reel 2.
Well, as well as giving the coordinates for this Harrison fire, we had other tasks to do. For example, the CO would come into what we were, you know, dugout or our office, where we were using as a dugout as an office, and demand to know where such and such was. And you had to know your job. You had to be able to pull out the relevant map. We had them all in rows, rolled up in slots, which we'd made ourselves out of old boxes. You had to pull out the relevant map, and you had to be able to show the girl exactly what he wanted to see. I mean, you had to know your job, otherwise, you wouldn't be there very long. And we had to do that, various other jobs. And then the one job we had to do, which at first was okay, but later wasn't, every so often, two of us would have to go up to the, sometimes only one of us, but usually two, go up to one of the forward companies and with a prismatic compass to the highest point. We were on a hill in one position called Hill 355, and they had built a dugout on the top to blend in with the hill, and you had a large open slit, I suppose it must be about 4 or 5 feet by about 18 inches, where you could look out across to where the enemy were way in the distance. And when the gunfire would start, usually in the afternoon, around about 3:30, they'd open up, and this would go on all afternoon, well into into the early evening. And we used to go up there with these prismatic compasses and a map in front of us, and we'd look through the compass and line up the flash, and then do a small sum and change the magnetic bearing to grid bearing, and then draw a line off where you were, because you knew where you were, obviously, off the map. And you'd pick up all these guns as the gun flashes, so you'd be able to, you'd end up with a lot of lines radiating from where you were, indicating where all the guns were actually found, so you could have a line of them. And then these were passed on to, I think they were passed on down the line to brigade, etc. And I think they went to the Americans, who had these very large caliber guns. I think they were called, I think they were 225 mil, I think they were called Long Toms, and I think they may have been passed to the carrier planes, which came over quite regularly, and that was quite exciting to watch when they were doing a bombing raid, which you could watch quite clearly, of course. And one of our other jobs up there as well was in the daytime, if we saw movement, which you would see from time to time, we'd call down on radio to the tanks, which were dug in, hull down Centurion tanks in the hill, and they would fire tracer shells, and we would correct their aim until they were on target, and then they would destroy the bunker or whatever which we had seen. And that was quite good. That went on, and numerous other jobs for quite a while. And then I went up there the one day, and we were watching this, doing the same thing, taking the gun positions, and the shell fire was particularly heavy this day. And of course, if for anyone who's never been under fire, it's like the films, I suppose it's like the war films you see on the television these days, or in the cinema, where they fire and you hear this loud screaming noise that comes in, and then it's over the top and it lands in the valley below, or it hits in the hill further down from where you are. So if you can picture it in your mind, you're right on top of the hill, you're looking out through this narrow slit, 18 by about 5 feet, 18 inches by about 5 feet, and they're landing in front of you, they're going over the top, and most of the time it doesn't bother you. You think, well, you don't think about it, you think they've got to be pretty accurate to hit you observing. And then one day you just start thinking about it, and I think if they drop one here now, Suya, you haven't got a prayer. For some reason, I started thinking that they might drop one through this hole, and you wouldn't have any chance at all if they drop one in here. And although I'd done this job, I mean, up there lots of times before, it suddenly got to me. I know it's possibly what was supposed in the First World War would have been called shell shock. I just went to pieces, and I just sat in the corner, and sergeant came up and he called a company commander. And I mean, it wasn't like in the First World War where they had no patience. I mean, he was of cowardice and things like that. He said, "Oh, you'll have to come down off the hill," he said. And the sergeant sort of more or less half carried me down off the hill. I wasn't wounded or anything. It was just a mental thing, you know, and I just couldn't handle it for a while. And then they rang the headquarters, and despite the shelling, which was quite heavy, our jeep driver, because you get every section has their own little jeep, he came up to fetch me, and that was, if anything, worse than being on the hill, because once you're off the top of the hill and you're down behind the hill, you're fairly safe in heavy shelling, because the shells are going to go over the top most of the time. But of course, he came to fetch me, and when we went back down, of course, we went down on this road, which was picking up all these shells that was coming over the top of the hill that I had been on. So that was a bit hair raising. I don't remember much of that. We came back and there was shells everywhere. And then we got back to HQ, and they took me to the medical place, our regimental medical place. And I couldn't remember anything about it. My mind was gone, so I couldn't remember a thing. And I can remember they tied a label to me, like a parcel label, which I found out later just had on it acute anxiety. And they sent me back to a field hospital, five, 10 miles behind the line. And I stayed there for, I think, about 3 or 4 weeks. And I was okay after. I recovered and I was fine. And I went up and did the same job again afterwards. But at the time, I don't know what have you, just one of those things, I suppose. And then shortly after that, that's right, I think it was in May or June in 52, a friend of mine got killed there, Arthur Rowe. He was a Valleys boy, but not from where I lived, a different place. And we'd gone in the army together the same day, or we met at the same, you know, we were in Brecon together as trainees. We met and got friendly and stayed together. And we used to go out together in the evenings and things. And when we went to Korea, when we were assigned out different things, as I was remarking earlier, he was given signals. He was taught to drive, and he was driving a jeep. And when we went to Korea, he was one of the lucky ones, or we thought he was. Behind the companies, you've got your headquarters company, then behind you, all of them, you've got brigade headquarters, then further back again, divisional headquarters. And each battalion, I think, is the same. They have what they call B echelon and A echelon. I don't know, one is further back than the others, but it's where the stores are and all the sort of the bulk of the stores and stuff like that. It's where everything gets brought up to the front from. And Arthur came up one day. He used to come up from time to time to battalion quarters, and we were having a chat together, saying, "Oh, okay, all things down there, you know." And we'd had particularly heavy shelling earlier in the day, and when you had heavy shelling, it tended to break up all the lines, because they're all lines run up to each company, you know, telephone lines. And of course you'd have to go out and send line pies to repair them, and most of them had been done, but some were still awaiting repair. And the signal sergeant said, "Do you mind running a line party, Arthur?" He said, "Out to A company." And Arthur said, "No, well, you wouldn't think nothing of it." He'd say, "Yeah, that's a beautiful day like this, glorious day." And "No," he said, "that's fine." He took them up and they went off and repaired the lines, and he was standing like away from them on his own, looking around, because I mean, for him it was a bit of a novelty not being up the front, of course, looking around. And they had a short mortar attack, and one landed near him and killed him instantly. And I couldn't believe it when the news came back to headquarters company, because we'd been together all the time, we were close friends. Although we had only, you know, sort of met since we both came into the forces. Anyway, you know, a boy that should have been safe, miles behind the line, misfortune, one of those things, I suppose, in the wrong place at the wrong time. He got killed, and that was quite upsetting for a while. But shortly after that, I went on what we used to call R&R, which is rest and recuperation leave to Tokyo. So that was very good. That helped the recovery from the breakdown and Arthur's death. We had a really good time there and enjoyed it. We were in a Canadian-run leave camp. and we quite enjoyed it. It was nice to see a big city there. And
what type of things did you do in Tokyo?
Well, we went to a Canadian run leave camp called Ebisu Camp, and I was with five others. Most of them were regulars, some were national service, and we got up in the morning, you had breakfast, you could have pretty well what you wanted, bacon and eggs, you could have cereals, you could have porridge, you could have whatever you wanted, you could have it. It was, you know, that was the whole idea, you could relax for a week. It was only a week, but it was a long week. And then we'd go out and find our way around and look at all the different things. And most often we'd be out and we'd be drinking. And I never drank before I went to the force, so I started drinking slightly before this. It was usually this Japanese bottled beer, which wasn't very strong anyway. But of course, at the time, when you've never been drinking, you don't know the sort of strengths of beers. And we had a damn good time. We went out with one gang of Australians, and the beer was in, bottles were all in a huge tub of ice. And these girls were serving them, and they poured them all into, they had rows and rows of glasses on what we would deem as a wooden baker's tray. And they'd fill all the glasses, then bring them round. You'd pay for this, because we had plenty of money, because, of course, the money was British Army Forces. We were getting paid every week, but nowhere to spend it on. Because when we were in Korea, the Nafi truck would come round, a 1500 truck would come round. I think it was once a week, or it might be once a fortnight, where you'd buy, like, soap and toothpaste and chocolate and stuff like that. Unlike the American Forces, where they get it all for nothing, of course. And so we had lots of money. So we went and spent it there, and we were buying each other tray loads of beer and all that stuff. Then I went out looking for the girls, and we went out, and the week ended where we, or the week, the pattern of the week was that we went out in the morning after breakfast and came back the next morning for breakfast. We didn't actually go home any single night. We stayed out all night, every night. So we had a wonderful time at the time. And then we went back, of course. And of course, part of that, again, as I said earlier about going on the ship, it was an experience for me, anyway, well, for most of them, I suppose. And it was an added experience when we were flown from Korea to Japan, because we landed at night at a place, I think it was called Tachikawa Air Base, but I can't remember. And you could see the whole city lit up beneath the enemy. It was a really big city then, you know, compared to, I mean, cities that you hadn't seen, well, you hadn't seen them from the air, obviously. So that was quite a novelty. Though looking back, of course, the planes, I think, were Dakotas or whatever they are. They were prop planes, and they were, looking back now, they were obviously most uncomfortable. But, I mean, I thought it was wonderful, and I was lucky enough not to be airsick either, so that helped. And the whole thing was an adventure, and I'd say you recovered, and you come back, and you do your time. You move from position to position. You pull out of the line. In the summer, we pulled out of one place in the line, and it was glorious weather. We walked around in sort of without our shirts for weeks on end, and then it was time to go back into the line. You had this brief rest, and you took over from different people each time. I mean, we met, you know, the Australians, French Canadians, New Zealanders, all the various Commonwealth people as well, and. One interesting thing when we were there, you had all the companies and HQ as well, you had large coloured, oblong coloured panels, bright red, I think they were bright yellow, something like that. And every day morning you had to put these panels out in a set pattern, that is the pattern for the day. And when the American carrier planes would come over, they would recognise that these were UN forces. Before I went out there, when the fighting, sort of hand-to-hand fighting was much more prevalent, I think, for example, the Argyll and Sullenders took one hill, were pushed off it, then it was retaken, but before they had time to put their aircraft and their identification panels out, the planes attacked it, napalmed the hill, killed quite a few Argyll and Sullenders Islanders. You know, where they were burnt, and it was sort of, I suppose, like a lot of these things, a misfortune of war. The hills were changing hands so quickly that they didn't really know where anyone was, and that's just one of those things where we were most fortunate. The other thing I didn't like we'd have a lot of, in the middle of the day, or perhaps in the mid-morning, bright sunny morning, you'd have a lot of airburst firing. You'd hear a crack, because you hear the sound first, of course. You'd hear a crack, and you'd look up, and you'd see a puff of black smoke, and then you'd have a hail of shrapnel coming down. Well, of course, once we'd been there, and for the first time, we realised what it was, as soon as you heard the crack, you hit the deck and covered your head a bit quickly and got in under cover anyway. And that was a bit unfriendly. I did bring some shrapnel home with me, and I kept it for many years. But I think when we moved from Cardiff to here, here in Sussex, I've never found it since, so I think it got mislaid in the move, and it's a pity, really. I kept it as a sort of memento, you know. And when you see these twisted pieces of shrapnel, you can understand when you read these war stories and understand the dreadful damage it does to people when it hits them, when it's flying through the air at speed. And that was another thing I didn't like. Eventually, we went to our last position, which was quite a quiet part of the line, and ready to come back. But, another interesting thing, these are not in sequence, as I remember them. One of our other job, we had an interpreter, a Korean interpreter, Sung, and he was a guy, I suppose he must be about 30 plus, heck of a nice guy. And, of course, he had a good little job because he was getting well fed at a time when, they didn't have the food. I remember it was just like watching one of these war films you see on the television or in the cinema where streams of refugees are going one way and you were going the other day. And I remember throwing them oranges and stuff and have some fruit and that, because they were all going the other way with all what they could carry on their backs. One of our other jobs was one of those intelligence section which I was in, from time to time went to one of the Republic of Korea, or the rocks as we call them, for the whole night, in up on one of their forward positions to sort of see what was going on and get a perspective from their point of view. And I'd go with this Sung, we'd get dropped off and stay the night and observe and report back to your HQ in the morning. And we went up there, I think it must have been about an August time, I can't remember exactly. And we went this one day, night, went up there, and we got attacked. There was a major attack in the night, and we got all hell loose, and we didn't know what the hell was going on. And I'm on the phone reporting back all the time what's going on, that the forward company was overrun, and we were pulling back, blah, blah, blah. And it was quite funny, really, because they had reinforcement. They retook the position, and things got sorted. But it was quite funny, because when I came back in the morning, my friend said, God, he said, you had them panicking here last night. He said they were packing up to pull back because we had prepared positions further back in case the line broke. He said they started to pack up. Yeah. Well, I said it was okay after. He said, yeah, but he said it was quite, he thought it was quite amusing. He said it was quite amusing for a while. He said they were running around, chasing their heads off. So that was quite funny. In that sense, it wasn't funny. Well, I didn't find it funny at the time when everything is sort of all hell gets lost loose and you don't know what's going on. And of course, I only had this Sung. Everyone else was speaking in Korean, so that wasn't. But I mean, you know, as soon as you find out what's going on, you pull back and stay with the others. But that was quite hair raising at the time, and I can't really think of other things. The things come back to you from time to time.
What did you think of the other Allied troops?
I thought they were very good. I find the Americans, I don't think much of their troops are all in as much as they're very lax and disciplined, and they're not like us at all. But they were in the one position we were in, because when you're in the line, you've got people on either side, of course. We had the American Marine Corps, and we found them excellent. They were first-class soldiers. Some of the others were rather more lax. And I mean, for an example, we went... they lack in ways, but in other ways they're very good. They're very generous people. In one place we were taking over from these Americans, so about six or seven of us, one from each section in headquarter company, went 10 days early to sort of get the lie of the land and sort things out, so you'd have it sort of all settled in your mind of where everybody was going to go. And it was highly amusing. We went for breakfast in the morning. They'd shove loads of rushes of bacon, fried eggs, And they say, you come back if you want more. And they say, we were delighted with this, all this food we were eating. I mean, I must say, so far as the British were concerned, we had excellent food in Korea. We had better food than when we were training over here, to be honest with you. When we were out training in Norfolk, the food was something to be desired, shall we say, less it was terrible. But out there, I think it was because when you're in barracks all year, the cooks are cooking for the whole battalion, I don't know, was it 1,000, 1,200 people? When you're over there, each outfit is separate, so they were cooking only for headquarter company. And we had quite nice meals. We, you know, we were having lamb chops and chips, the sort of thing you'd have at home. We had a lot of turkey. A lot of evening meals were turkey, and then tinned fruit afterwards. In fact, it was quite funny, because when I got home, only about, I think it was 3 or 4 days before Christmas, and my mother said, oh, lovely for Christmas, we got a nice turkey for Christmas dinner. And if you think at the time, most people had a chicken at Christmas. They didn't have chicken like, no, we have chicken when we wanted, more or less. They had chicken, because that was the Christmas dinner. But then turkeys became the thing. And I said, no, I said, I tell you what, I said, a bit of beef would be nice. I said, I've had enough turkey this last 12 months. And when they think you've had a damn good time, you know, but the food was good. But going back to when we went to this American outfit for a few days, they cooked the front, the evening meal, the breakfast meal. Then in the evening, the lunch meal or the evening meal is brought up to them. And southern fried chicken, ice cream. We were looking at this stuff, we thought, God, this is a good outfit. We've been in the wrong army here, boy. And we were really enjoying this. It was wonderful. And, you know, the other thing I liked, and I said to you earlier, the Naffy truck used to come around to us every so often, and you'd buy razor blades, and you'd buy soap and chocolate and sugar and various bits of it. You were making your own brews and that. But we went down to what is called the PX, and these long tables, trestles were laid out with a cloth, there was razor blades, soap, all manner of things on this table. We went along, and we were looking a bit, you know, because it's all in American. So he said, well, how much is this? And he said, how much is that? Oh, he said, you don't pay for any of this, he said. This is the PX. He said, you just pick up anything you want and take it. He said, we'll be back again tomorrow. And I thought, God, this is a good outfit to be in. So we loaded ourselves up with razor blades and soap and everything else, because it was excellent, you know. And another recollection, when we're in the line, of course, you needed to keep clean. You could grow a beard, but we quickly found that when you had to wear a lot of your clothes for lengths of time without changing them, you quickly found that if you could have a hot bath or a hot wash, or you kept yourself clean shaven, because it was I've heard it said before, and it is true, it's a big morale booster. You feel when you've shaven off, and you feel more alert, more alive. That's what we found. And what they did they had a section of men that dealt purely with latrines and baths and things. And what they did, they had cut completely lengthways in half, 55-gallon drums, fuel drums, which obviously had been, I don't know what they did. They must have cleaned them and scoured them and did whatever, steamed them all off, I think, back in behind the line depots. Anyway, they fetched a lot of these up, and they had huge fires, and they'd filled these sort of three parts full of nice hot water, and you'd get in there and have a nice, so once a week you'd have a nice hot bath, hopefully, depending on, you know, what was happening at the time. Because you see, what a lot of people don't realise, when you're on active service in a place like that, wars are not run on a 9-to-5 basis. And what happens is, if you get a lively night and there's a lot of gunfire and things going on, especially when you're in it, because all the companies are on full alert, and you don't get no sleeping in the headquarter company, you're all up, and especially in the section we were in, you'd have maps, phone calls, the phone would be going, one of us would be on duty in the sort of actual, the office, if you like, but it was a dugout, and everybody else would be up on the hill, dug in their respective places. Then if it got lively, you called the rest of them out, the phone would be going non-stop from the different companies, telling what was happening in front of them, and then it would pass off, and then the morning would come. Well, it was none of this then of those up in the night would now go to bed, you'd catch up sleep where you could. Like, each the sergeant would say, look, it's pretty quiet now, you two go up and get a few hours, you know. And of course, it's very difficult to sleep in the middle of a summer's day, but you would. And talking about summer, talking about weather, these things are all out of sequence, really. But in the winter, when I went out there first, it was November, and then it's a funny thing in Korea. I don't know if it applies generally to the Far East. Unlike this country, where when we had our season more settled, you get, so like, we get mild winter sometimes, or we get, when I was a child, we saw a lot of really bad winter, especially where we lived up in the hills. But out there, the seasons change abruptly, and they change almost to the calendar, the impression I got. You had your summer, long, hot summer days, but when we went there, of course, it was in the autumn, and then it was November, and it wasn't really cold, it was wet, a lot of wet. Then suddenly, within weeks, it suddenly started to get cold, and it suddenly started to get very, very cold. And of course, our clothing was changed, and we were given, we wore khaki long johns with like a sort of smooth outside, like a pair of conventional trousers, but inside like a thick lining, like not fur, but a sort of wool, I don't know. So we wore them, a vest, a sleeveless vest, a string vest, then your army shirt over the top of that. And the idea of this string vest, because of course they sold them to the public years later, was that when you put the shirt on top of the vest, all the little holes in the vest became, the theory was they became air pockets of warm air. Because the one thing you find in learning Korea, as everyone knows now, of course, is that you don't keep yourself warm if you're in big, thick, heavy things on. You keep yourself warm if you're in layers on. Layers. So this vest, shirt, a big, heavy sweater with a square top with it that you tied off, and then you put your combat trousers on. That's these green, windproof trousers, and a combat jacket, which should come down to sort of mid-thigh. It's zipped up and buttoned. You'd have a hood you'd put up, and you'd pull it down tight. Then on top of that, you'd have a parka, a big sort of quilted coat, and the hood would be sort of fur-lined. It was simulated, you know, so it wasn't fur, obviously. And you'd pull this sort of in extremely cold weather. You had all this gear on. You'd zip it up, and then the hood had a wire. You can buy them now in shops, the similar sort of thing. But that's where it all originated from. And you closed in the wire when you're on guard duty night, because you had to do 2 hours. But what you did in the day, you had to do 2 hours, two of you at a time on, every night, right? And if you were on sort of 2 to 4, or perhaps 12 to 2, when on it, when it's a particularly cold night, I mean, you dare not take your gloves off, because you'd get frostbite. And these hoods on the park, you'd pull them up, and they had a wire frame in the top. Like, if you can imagine a circle of the hood with a frame, and you'd squeeze it down to just a slit you could look out through. And, you know, you'd walk out. And I think it was Korea where the tough boots, so-called, TUF, the tough boots were originated. I mean, these cleated soles. What they did, everyone had boots two sizes bigger than they took. And you put in a very thick nylon insole, you know, like an insole, that you like cutting a piece of material out the same shape as the inside of the shoe. And that was in, and the idea was you could stand, because of course they were cleated soles, the air was moved through them, you could stand for long periods, or of course it paid you to move. It's insulated your feet, and it worked very well. Because when we first went out there, you see, we had ordinary army boots, I think we had to start with, and ordinary khaki uniforms, which of course would have been totally useless when the winter came. That's why when troops went out there first, they were caught with this sort of weather. I suppose a little bit like the German troops getting caught on the attack on Russia. You know, the summer ended and suddenly they had summer clothes and the winter came. Anyway, we were very lucky. We had all this gear, and it was a bit cumbersome, but the point is it kept you warm. And the only thing is, of course, if you would have to fire your weapon, you'd have had to take at least one of these. You'd have to take the big outer gauntlets off, certainly, because in the winter, because it's very similar to this country, you get heavy snow, but you get snow, so it's white everywhere, the hills, and you had white trousers to put over everything else you had on, white trousers, and a white smock, hooded smock, which of course would have to be quite large to go over everything. So you zip that up so that you couldn't be seen should you be attacked, you know, because of course, I suppose it's a bit like saying we're all Orientals, they all look the same to us. I mean, a North Korean or a South Korean wouldn't look any different as far as we were concerned. If they